FreedomSlips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it, then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning! Warning!
We gotta stop them! They're gonna kill us all!
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone, or human beings!
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, by all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop, and you've got to win the day to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at FreedomSlips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well now you got it.
Rest, you tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio!
We did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyal? Is it treason to oppose the hands of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me,
give me liberty! Oh, give me!
A dark cloud is finally lifting across the world as U.S. military intelligence and their global partners are destroying the deep state criminal power structure that has ruled over our planet for hundreds of years.
We are free with the God-given right, and we shall not yield that right to any power on earth.
Hi, I'm Scott McKay. The world is at, and I am your host on The Tipping Point. On Revolution Radio, where every Monday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, we bring you the latest in this ensuing takedown of this global criminal empire.
That's an image of strength.
You'll get the raw, hard truth here on The Tipping Point. So come join us Mondays, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, in Studio B at revolution.radio.
Thanks for listening while we take this short break.
Here
at Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com.
Can't hear you.
Yeah, we're going to get back to
enough
the
music or not. So let's free after. So I guess we're going to start. So if you can hear me on Studio B, please let me know. This is Ed.
And this is Jeff. Happy Tuesday.
For Polite Gunfight. Yes, Mr. Aaron is cannot join us tonight. He's having some plumbing issues, and we're talking about the kind in the house, and not, you know, not physiological plumbing issues. So we wish him well tonight, and we glad you're here. So again, please let us know if you can hear Studio B, because we kind of got all screwed up because of the bumper music. We can't hear it, and we're just hoping that everything is flying right. And here, Studio B. It's kind of, you know. So we'll just talk until we hear it. Anyway, so how are you today, Mr. Jeff?
Oh, I'm doing all right. Doing all right. You know, just getting back into the swing of things. I was off last week and just, I guess it was the week before. I don't know. It, this year has become a blur as well. And just action-packed weekend and just, trying to get back into the work mode. Hectic as ever,
It takes a little time to get back in the swing of things, doesn't it, once you take some time off, like a week?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've always said the mark of a good vacation is when you come back and you can't remember any of your passwords.
Yes. You and I are of the same mind. That's how I know I did it correctly, when it's like, huh? And it takes a moment or four to, like, okay, I think it was blah, blah, blah. You know? Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Right, right. And then you're just like, man, you feel so sluggish. Like, man, I kind of did have a rhythm and a way through all this. And then you just like, you know, it takes a while to get your pace back, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You find yourself fumbling over things you thought, you know, that you didn't even realize you, you know, had down, right?
Right.
So, anyway, well, we're back, and, you know, we try not to take too many breaks off of the show because, you know, I have a good time, and I know Jeff does, and I know Aaron does, and so we, you know, are fortunate to be here.
So, yes, I feel it's very fortunate to have this time to spend communing with you and Ed and, you know, those out there that may be listening and, you know, throw some comments our way.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they're listening. They're listening. For sure. Hey, so let me tell you this. I've been this has been kind of a weird couple days here. Did you happen to see a comment made during the hearings on the Supreme Court that Sonia Sotomayor made? Did you hear the comments that she made by chance?
Oh, no. Don't know anything about it.
Well, she said, I mean, this is a pretty close quote, if not dead on. She said that at this point in time, there are 100,000 children in the hospital on ventilators due to COVID. 100,000. 100,000
Yeah.
Children on ventilators.
Yeah. 1 in 5 zeros.
Yes. So.
I don't know that one way or the other. That sounds high, though.
Well, it is a little high because, when fact checked, it's actually kind of hard to get the current actual number because there are, at this point in time, some 5,000 children in the hospital right now, total.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And maybe 2,000 are there due to COVID. And of that, it's even a lot less that on ventilators.
Mm-hmm.
But if we were to say that every child that was in hospital on with COVID was on a vent, that would max out at 2,000, which last time I checked is a pretty far cry from 100,000.
Yes.
You know, NPR, AP News, entity by Bastion by any stretch of the imagination, right? They were busting on her and saying that that was very crazy that she had said those things, right?
Right. Oh, so you're saying NPR said that?
NPR that was yes,
out of line.
Busting okay. on her. Yeah. So
yeah, they're very lefty and very supportive of progressive thought. Yes.
Right.
And very liberal. Oh, wow. Okay.
So, there's 9 Supreme Court justices, right?
Yes.
I mean, I'm not too comfortable with her having a vote in this manner. If she is under the understanding that 100,000 children are on ventilators at this moment with COVID, I don't think I want her representing, you know, calling the balls and the strikes in this manner because she is either grossly uninformed or something, you know. That's a pretty easy thing to, if someone presented her with that, that'd be very easy for her to, you know, fact check it, right?
Well, have one of her interns fact check. She doesn't have to do it. She got people for that, you know.
She does. She has clerks.
Yeah, you're right. That does concern me because usually the Supreme Court stays pretty quiet about all sorts of things, and there's probably a good reason for it. I mean, Now it begs the question, at least to me, it's like, okay, what if some of these other Supreme Court justices, what would they have said? You know, would they all be so outlandish and make these sorts of remarks? I don't know, right? I mean, is this par for the course? I just don't know that. Yeah, you know, and maybe that's why they keep quiet. I mean, what would, you know, Antonin Scalia say, or what would have, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg say?
Right.
You know, just out of curiosity, you know, would they have shared all sorts of unfact-checked, off-the-cuff remarks, or would they have been a little more careful with statements? But very curious. On my part.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, concerning that, okay, this person is one of nine on the planet, you know?
Right, one of nine on the planet that gets to weigh in.
Job for life, yes.
Right, and they get to weigh in on this. They get to weigh on this very important matter, whether or not OSHA can enforce a vaccine mandate for employers with over 100 employees.
Okay.
Right. That's what this is in relation to. This is what is at stake. Is, you know, does OSHA have the ability? Does OSHA have the authority?
The right. The authority. Yes.
To state that this is a workplace emergency, and that any company with over 100 employees needs to mandate that they're vaccinated, or endure, you know, very stiff penalties.
Okay.
Anywhere between $700 and $7,000 per violation.
Ouch. Ouch, I say.
So.
Yeah.
She earned 4 Pinocchios from the Washington Post. And the Washington Post is, also no right-leaning,
no
paper.
That's right. 4 Pinocchios. Wow. Okay.
So, yeah, exactly. Anyway, that's troubling. I don't know if you've been following the arguments or anything from the Supreme Court. It's basically with New York, Ohio has taken this up. So they are pretty much the ones that are taking exception and raise this all the way up to the Supreme Court. So they had both people from OSHA and also people from the state of Ohio. Lawyers from the state of Ohio arguing this. So, you know, I mean, it doesn't, you know, it matters. It doesn't exactly matter, you know, what people think, you know, what side they lay on. And that's, you know, people are allowed to have their own opinions about whether or not they believe this OSHA should be able to mandate this vaccine. However, it does bother me that the Supreme Court Justice Sotomayor is just way out in left field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she doesn't have the facts correct, and she may be making her opinion and arguments within chambers to her 8 other peers with misinformation. Yeah, that's not good, and I think that's been an issue with this pandemic all along, people getting misinformation. So, you know, they're being misled, you know, and that's not helpful.
No, it's not.
I mean, as a kid, I remember lifting up an arm and getting the polio and the smallpox vaccines. And okay, maybe I was too young to realize and hear any of the outrage and concern and protest over that sort of thing. But, you know, I certainly remember doing that in school, you know, just, okay, everybody get up, go stand in line, lift up your shirt, you know, lift up your right or left sleeve, excuse me, and, you know, You go through the line, you walk up, school nurse zaps you with the gun, next one, zapped with the gun, next one. I mean, there's no argument, no protesting, no nothing.
No, right.
You know, and polio isn't contagious. Smallpox is, but polio isn't, so it's not like, oh, okay, well, if you're not vaccinated, Jeff, you can give it to the rest of the class. No, it's not how it works.
Yeah, polio spread, one second here, sorry. Well, yeah, polio is, it's one of those, fecal oral transmission things. Where like, you know, the stool of an infected person introduced to the mouth of, you know, it's like a water problem, you know, it was
contaminated water, yeah.
Right, which, you know, I would hope that in the state, you know, where we have much better facilities of cleaner water in the United States, I hope that, you know, it really wouldn't spread, right? As quickly
agreed.
As it did way back when, right?
Mm-hmm. I wholeheartedly agree. And we have water treatment plants here. So even if, you know, some sort of line backed up or, you know, some sort of raw sewage somehow got in there, the water treatment plant would handle it for us. But,
I mean.
Yeah. I don't get it. I don't know how this became a political issue. It's a global pandemic, not caused by the Republicans or Democrats, you know. And if you're going to – anybody's going to claim conspiracy, well, it's a global conspiracy by all governments, some of which are sworn enemies of ours. So it's not even like they all like us and, okay, we think this is the best way to – handle our citizenry, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, right. So that was one thing that really caught me off guard on just kind of ticked me off. The other thing is that did you happen to hear Biden speak today?
No. No, I make it a point not to listen to him. It just infuriates me.
agreed. Yeah. Well, today he made his speech about well, wait. You know what? I think we can actually hear his speech. Do you want to hear his speech real quick?
Sure.
Let's see if we can wait. Let me see. Is it can we? It's just a minute eight here, and this is President Biden. And so here we go. Let's see. Can we hear this? Let me know if you can hear this. Here we go. Hold on. No, I just want to listen to the quote. Would you please quit? Man, you try to play something and everything jumps in your way. All right. Mm-hmm. Here we go.
The United States Senate.
Can you hear that?
We have 51
yes.
presidents.
No, I can't.
Of working with senators my whole career, but man, when you got 51 presidents, it gets harder. Any one can change the outcome. Sadly, the United States Senate, designed to be the world's greatest deliberative body, has been rendered a shell of its former self. It gives me no satisfaction in saying that, as an institutionalist, as a man who was honored to serve in the Senate. But as an institutionalist, I believe that the threat to our democracy is so grave that we must find a way to pass these voting rights bills. Debate them. Vote. Let the majority prevail. And if that bare minimum is blocked, we have no option but to change the Senate rules, including getting rid of the filibuster for this.
Okay, so did you hear that?
Mm-hmm. I did. I did read a little bit about, yeah, him not wanting to get rid of the filibuster. And it's like, okay. And then when the Republicans are in charge or, you know, whatever, then what happens, right? You lost it. And I think this still goes back to the Joe Manchin, You know, he's not for whatever. He's not drinking what Joe's pouring out, right? He's not taking all of the Kool-Aid down, and Bill's ha- or Bill, Joe's having problems with that.
Yep. So he said, and voting is very important. The will of the people is very important, and we're going to vote. We're going to debate it. And if this doesn't work, we're going to get rid of the filibuster so we can get what we want.
Exactly. And I did read someplace this week they were thinking of letting illegal immigrants vote too. And it's like, no, that is a privilege for citizens of this country, not for aliens. Okay, naturalized citizens, that's fine. But if you're not a naturalized or you know, natural born citizen here, then you do not get to vote.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I'm going with that. You know, it's like, no. That's one of the privileges of being an American citizen. You get the right to vote. That is not a privilege of somebody who is not an American citizen.
I don't think, I mean, I have no idea why there would be any other way to go about that. I mean, I don't even know why that would be a discussion. Why anyone would ever think about talking about that.
I think he wants more votes, and that's one way to do it, right?
Well,
in his mind, get minorities to vote for him that are, illegal aliens. Because the stereotype is it's all the minorities that are the illegal aliens, you know?
Right, right. But, I mean, that's just really out of bounds for what? I mean, that's just, you know, people that don't have driver's license, they should be allowed to drive.
Right.
No, they shouldn't. I mean, this is even crazier than that, right?
So, this is much crazier than that. You know, I don't have an issue with them driving. I mean, that's not part of the Constitution. They're not changing the way government works, you know?
Yeah, and
sure, there are some people that have problems with illegal aliens driving, but I think, you know what? I know where on my driver's license. Well, I guess I need to provide a birth certificate or a Social Security card a million years ago when I did get my driver's license. I'm not sure what's required nowadays.
Well, I mean, sure, it's the same thing. You have to provide your birth certificate to get a driver's license. You can't just, you know, can't just walk up and say, I want a driver's license, right?
Right, I want one. And you're going to give me one just because I smile at you.
Or frown at you.
Or frown.
No, exactly. So that's just unconscionable. Right. And people are saying, I mean, it's not even a dream is all that is needed. Pull a gunfight, a dream. So if you have a dream, that means you belong in this country.
Okay.
Because you want to make your life a better place. You want to, the lives of your children and your family to be a better place. So you have this dream. So that means that you are allowed in this country, but not even for citizenship necessarily, just the vote, right? Just the vote. So, I mean, what are you going to vote for? You're going to vote for whatever you perceive the people that are helping you out are giving you for free, right?
Right.
Why wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why wouldn't you vote for the Democrats? I mean, you're going to come in here and say, well, I think to make this fair, I don't think I really should be here. So I'm going to vote to make sure that I can't stay here and my family can't stay here and we lose all our benefits, right? I mean, how's that going to happen?
Yeah, how's that going to work? Right. Totally agree.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's just... you're buying votes in the in every way, shape, or form of the word without, you know, actually bribing people with money.
Mm-hmm. Yep, you're enticing them with potential for citizenship or the need to not get citizenship and still gain the benefits. You know, that's like, okay, you don't have to be a citizen. Just show up and, oh, vote for this party because they allowed it. Don't you forget it.
And you know, your family is one that has your heritage has come just like my heritage has come from another country, right?
Yep.
And you migrated to the United States and went through the proper channels and
yeah, sure did. I mean, my parents, you know, took their citizenship lessons and all of that, the civics lessons and stuff, and became naturalized citizens. I was born here, so I was a you know, already a citizen by birth, and yeah, I'm very proud of the fact that I'm a citizen. I wouldn't think twice of it, you know, and don't take it for granted in the least. And you know, I appreciate it. I mean, it's certainly given me a better life and certainly more opportunities than if we lived in Hong Kong, you know. And I'm sure the same can be said for your parents and ancestors.
Oh yeah, my it was my on my father's side. My grandfather's father came over here when he was a teenager, and my grandfather's father came over here when he was a teenager, and my grandmother's mother was first generation born here, and my grandmother's parents, they both came, you know, were first generation here as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, you know, there was, you know, they got here, and what did they want to do? They wanted to assimilate. They cooked their pierogi and their kapusta and their krestiki and gumki, and you know, but they wanted to learn English. They taught their children English.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to be. They were thrilled to be here. They kept their traditions, but they also took on American traditions, right?
Right. Yeah.
My great Uncle Judgy was a shot in the beer guy. Always had to have had a shot in the beer, and that went on to my grandfather and, you know, somewhat my father. You know, it was always. It was always part of having company over, you know. Someone came over, yep. Gave him a shot and a beer.
Sure. Yep. So. And, you know, tradition in our household was any time somebody came over, you absolutely ask them if they've eaten yet. You know, it's very likened to the Pittsburghies. Jeet yet?
No Jew?
Yeah.
Right.
And that's what it's like. I mean, Cantonese culture is that way. I mean, that is a very proper greeting for somebody is to ask if they've eaten yet. You don't need to say, hey, how are you? It's like, have you eaten yet? And if they say no, then, you know, okay, well, let me fix you something. Or, hey, let's go out and grab a bite or something. You know, I mean, it's very accepted. You don't have to say, hi, how are you? It's just as reasonable to ask, have you eaten yet? You know, and if you have, then hey, can I get you a snack? How about a cup of tea or yeah, a shot of beer? If that's what you drink, right? Or a glass of wine, whiskey, whatever. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
You know, you say that, and I went over to Chen. Which culture claims a shot in a beer for themselves? Oh, yeah. Well, the Polacks do for sure.
Mm-hmm.
They'll have a shot in a beer. Oh, he says it's pretty universal. Yeah, probably is. But I think it's more. But I do believe it's more of a you know, Ukraine, Polish kind of that area kind of country. But you know, maybe not. But that's what I.
No, I think so. I think so. I mean, typically, growing up Chinese, you know, it was typically like cup of tea and some munchies or like a full blown meal. If they came over and didn't have anything to eat, it's like, okay, well, you know, you guys sit and talk. We'll whip something up, you know. But you know, somebody wanted some other liquid beverage. It was not thought differently. And it's like, okay, well, I'll get you one of those then, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I was saying, I went over to a Chinese student's when I was in college, and went over to his house. And he had, see, he came over when he was like 15 or 16, and the whole family came over. And because they, his father got a job at the university. And his father kind of spoke English, and he got a job teaching at the math department. Mm-hmm. Brought his son over and his wife over, and his wife barely spoke any English at all. And I went over there, and she just was sitting in the kitchen and chopping up these vegetables, you know, and mm-hmm. boiled water and threw it in there and pretty much just like had boiled vegetables for like lunch and offered me some, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no, thank you. I'm good. But it was just, you know, it was interesting, you know, never. And that was something that, you know, she had rice with it, too. You know, that was interesting. Like, you know, never did my mom chop up vegetables and throw it in boiling water and add some rice to it and eat it for lunch, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Just not the way it happened in my house, you know.
What? I bet not, you know, whereas in my house, at a minimum, twice a day, every day, rice went with everything. Well, everything went with rice is a better way to put it, because you get a big bowl of rice and then, okay, you'd grab some veggies and some meat, you know, off the communal plate of food there. And that was the meal, but it was mostly rice and, you know, supplemented by vegetables and meat, as opposed to meat and vegetables supplemented by starch, you know?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and, you know, usually in the breakfast, in the morning time, if it was school time, my sister and I would be scrambling for the bus. So it's like, okay, you can grab something good for you, and if you can't, you can't. And in the summertime, it's like, okay, you know, we might have rice or we might have something else. But, yeah, rice was definitely a lunch and dinner thing for sure.
Yeah, how does one, like, get rice on the go? Like, I'm running on my bus. How do you get, you know, how can you take rice on the run, you know? Or can you?
Nowadays you can. You just, you know, like take a to-go container with you and just put some rice and some veggies and some meat and just eat it on the bus, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But in the old days, no, you're right. They didn't have Tupperware and stuff like that, right? So
right.
It just didn't happen, you know? You grab some fruit or what have you, and you know, ran like a madman for the bus stop.
So, Walther Mazur, I apologize. I'm mispronouncing his name. He's talking about the rice balls. I guess that's when you roll up rice into like a ball kind of thing. Is that something that
There are certain varieties of rice. Not all rice is the same.
No, it is not.
Grain, I guess. Okay, so some rice is stickier than others. The Japanese tend to like sticky rice, whereas if you give me sticky rice, I just think you put too much water in it and didn't cook it properly. And, yeah, the Japanese sometimes they'll have sticky rice, and, yeah, you can pick that up with your hands because it's sticky and it kind of forms a rice ball. And I believe the Filipinos – and maybe Indonesians also eat their rice like that. You know, just with their hands, just pick up a little handful of sticky rice and, you know, have it with sauces or their meats and vegetables.
Yeah, right.
Whatever gets in the belly works, right?
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
Sorry, there's no right one way or right way or correct way. I know Ms. Manners would disagree, but it's like people eat all different ways around the world, and yet we're all alive and have succeeded to survive using our different eating techniques.
What, rice jasmine? Jasmine rice.
Mm-hmm. Jasmine rice, there's basmati rice, black rice, there's the more typical Chinese restaurant white long grain rice, and brown rice, those are the ones that come to mind right away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I used to do basmati and jasmine rice. I tend to like those, I think, the most.
They're nice. They're flavorful. The jasmine and basmati have a nice look to them instead of just the generic rice grain look of the typical long grain rice. Mm-hmm.
And they tend flavorful. Not to mush as much. You know what I mean? I mean, obviously, it all depends on how you cook it, but it's harder to mush.
It does depend on how much water you put in when you're cooking it.
Right, that's true.
And that's the issue. You put too much water, well, your food gets waterlogged, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's all there is to it, you know?
Yep, that's true. That's true. Yeah, I make it, you know, it's a good staple for my family. And my wife and I had to we had to take this class for fostering children, and one of the child was speaking about how, you know, they were not respected growing up in their house because the family said, "What do you want for breakfast?" And he was from China, and he said, "I want rice." And they said, "You can't have rice for breakfast. That's silly." Right. Well, of course it's not silly, right?
No.
Of course that was what he was used to, right? And of course, mm-hmm. The family should have said, "Oh, okay. Well, yeah, this child, you know, we probably need to do a little history on, you know, his culture and be, you know, cognizant of his culture, right? And probably give him things that'll make him more comfortable, right?" So that's all fine, right? You would agree with that, right?
But to an extent, but if you were adopting or fostering a Mexican child, would you be expected to make empanadas or
right? Well,
tamales for breakfast?
Exactly.
I mean, I would think if the child is being fostered by American parents, meaning, you know, probably of European descent, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you're going to have breakfast that you're comfortable with. You're not going to switch your diet around to match this child's, right?
Right.
That just seems strange. I mean, I might not phrase it as, "Oh, that's silly," but I would find a way to phrase it differently. Say, you know, "Sorry, Billy, but, you know, we don't typically have rice for breakfast. We have pancakes, waffles, croissants, bagels,
oatmeal, toast,
oatmeal,
cereal,
you know, high fructose corn syrup, sugar, cereal, right?"
Right.
But I wouldn't, "Oh, that's silly." No, it's not silly. It's valid for that kid, but okay, that's just not something you do, you know?
Yes, exactly. And my, you know, my point was like, watching this kid, it's like, "Listen, little punk, your life was saved. You know,
you know,
quit being a shit about this." Sorry, didn't mean to swear. "Quit being a stinker about this and understand that your life was saved and someone did a great service by bringing you into their home. I think you could manage with, you know, a Pop-Tart. Okay.
I think you could manage with being fed instead of being hungry."
Exactly.
How's that?
I wanted to strangle the kid, and I'm supposed to be learning how I could be more sensitive, and I felt like I was less sensitive over this little story. I wanted to strangle the little kid for being a snot.
If I was there, I would have corrected him immediately, and I probably would have been ejected from the class. But it's like, listen, you should be grateful for what these people have done to take the opportunity, the risk, and the effort, expense, and everything to take care of you. You know, exactly. Would you rather be in the orphanage or wherever you came from? You know, whatever your family situation was. Yeah, you can go back to having rice for breakfast, but I bet that's all you'd get. You're not having rice with anything else. And or, okay, yeah, you can have rice every day, but there's not going to be much vegetables or meat or anything else, you know?
Right.
And okay, what kind of opportunities are you going to get living that kind of lifestyle?
Right.
Good luck with that.
Is that rice going to send you to college? Is it going to get you a license? Are you, you know what I mean? Is that rice going to take you on vacation?
Right. Well, that and, okay, rice is a starch. It's not really full of nutrients. Just like potatoes, its job is to kind of fill the belly. Well, you need all of the other things for your body to grow. And guess what? Here in America, this is the land of plenty. You know, this is the, you know, as my parents and grandparents always said, you know, the streets aren't literally paved with gold, but if you work a little bit, there will be gold to be had because there's just so many opportunities and not just financially, but just, okay, you get to eat better. You get to live in better conditions. You get to actually own a car. You actually get to live in relative safety, and you don't have to worry about people kicking down your door and disappearing you in the middle of the night. And, you know, they're just all of these benefits that it sounds like that child just probably too young to get. But it's like, okay, honestly, you don't know how lucky you are until you go travel and or grow up a little bit and do some reading about how other people live. And it's like, I don't have that issue, right? Or, ooh, yeah, glad I don't live there, right? You know?
And you know, and when I said things of opportunity, I mentioned going to college, and I understand that, I know that, Punk Rabbit is saying, you know, why go to college? It's not that actually, you know, a great place to be, you know, and I think that, there's some validity to sending kids to college on what they're learning, you know, what they're being presented with and what they're learning. At the same time, you know, I think there's a lot, still a lot of validity in a good college education when you have a major that, you know, actually can get something for you, right? I mean, I wouldn't subscribe to sending kids to college to get a liberal arts degree in basket weaving, right? Or in something that they couldn't earn, you know, a good wage.
A living wage
with, right? But at the same time, you know, and also the liberal, you know, the liberal universities, you know, they have an agenda, you know, by and large, what is happening within today's society, you know, has been born and bred on college campi, right, over the years. I mean, it was ever present when I was in college at Penn State, and it continues to be more so to this day. And it's kind of like the breeding ground for new terrible ideas of leftism, you know. But at the same time, it doesn't have to take a hold of you, right? You don't have to be a part of that. You know, I wasn't of political mind when I went there and couldn't tell you the difference between the liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican. And yet I knew what I believed and I knew that there was a lot of nonsense being spouted, even though I didn't know what it was. I just knew what I believed in and what I didn't believe in. And it, you know, really wasn't worth it, you know, for me to be a part of that. And I got my degree and got out. So.
I will also say something in an addendum to Punk Rabbit. If you don't want to go to college, that's fine. Then go to a trade school, because to me, that's just as honorable and realistic a job and career as something you'd get in college. Certainly to your point, Ed, more realistic than getting some sort of, oh, master in fine arts or religious studies degree. Okay, if you're going into a religious field somehow, then religious studies make sense. But if you're not going to, you know, become a priest, a pastor or something like that, you know, what do you do with that degree?
Yeah.
You know, how do you earn money to support yourself and any kids you may have? And whereas, okay, you don't want to go to college. That's cool. Well, get a trade then. HVAC.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You know, and learn to be an electrical lineman, and any of that. You make good money doing that. Those people are in high demand, always required. And those are skills that you can go to any city and find a job because they need people like that.
And that's way, well, that's one thing that, that Punk Rabbit, he agrees with you. He said, how about a trade? Sure. Trade schools are fine.
Yeah.
They're better than fine. They're great.
Yes, absolutely.
And, you know, there are many good trades. I mean, you're right. Electricians are always in demand. There's, you know, they're not going to do away with electricity, anytime soon, whether it be in people's houses or commercially speaking, plumbing. Always need a toilet flushed.
Right.
And you're going
to, unless you want to go back to the old days and, have an outhouse out back or just dig a hole and do it that way. Right. I mean, you know, you're always going to need plumbing.
But I mean, I know for my son in particular, he's not a hands-on kid. He would not do well going to a trade school. He's not at this point in his life. He is not, you know, he wouldn't be pulling wire. He wouldn't be putting together a circuit panel, a panel box, right?
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't think that way. You know, he's not going to run copper pipe. He's not going to sweat copper pipe together or the new PEX, right? That's just not him.
And that's fine. Those aren't his gifts and those aren't his strengths. But for some people, that's what their gifts and strengths are. And there's not a darn thing wrong with it, you know? And you're going to be a productive member of society. I'm all for it.
And you know, there's nothing wrong
with that.
And you know what we do need more of that we don't have enough of is machinists.
Mm-hmm.
We need machinists. That's a trade.
Yeah.
When people talk about trade, they talk about HVAC, they talk about electricians, they talk about plumbers. But we definitely need machinists. If we're going to get this country, if we're going to have, you know, factories running here again, and we're going to be self-sufficient on our production again, we need machinists out the wazoo. And
that's a very great point.
And that's something that we definitely need. And yeah, when I was without a job a couple of years ago, I went and talked to the electrical union because I talked to some people in the electrical trade and they're like, you're not going to be able to, get any work unless you belong to the union.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to make any money on it. Unless you belong to the union, unless
right.
you go to a trade school from a union. So I started talking to them and they said, well, you know, how old are you? And I told them my age and they're like, forget it. We're never going to let you in our school because you're too old. You have to be,
right.
you have to be young because you have to go through their system and you have to be the
yep.
low man on the totem pole, the low person on the totem pole. And work your
yep.
way up.
And be an apprentice for X number of years. Absolutely.
Yeah. You have to have people sticking their finger in your chest saying, do this, do that. And, you know, no one's going to be telling an older person to do that. So they don't want it. They don't want you in their business. So, you know, it's not like you can always just become an electrician. Or an HV, or you know, plumber or something like that, right? Now, you know, and a plumber. My friend became a plumber in his late 30s, and he has a wildly successful HVAC plumbing business. Sure, that's awesome. And there's nothing against it, and I'll never say anything bad about going into trade school at all. Because it's desperately needed. I know when there was a stigma when I was in college, in high school. I didn't want to get a trade. I wanted to go to college. And, you know, I think I do well with my college degree.
Yeah, I would agree. But, you know, just for those people that object to college, it's like, oh, no, you just got to get a usable skill. And trade schools are absolutely valid and valuable for that sort of thing. And, you know, you can work for many, many years and make good money doing that and support yourself and a family if you choose to have one, you know, and have nice vacations, have nice cars, have all sorts of nice things, you know. And to me, it's very reasonable profession.
And sure, and Fleeberg was saying the same thing, you know, like he's talking about carpenters unions, being an apprentice, you know, people that people want to, you know, people that have been in the trades and the unions for so long, they want to protect themselves, right? So they want to protect their work. So it's kind of like it's a look down at the new guy until you work your way up. So anyway, so
Well, and even here in Pittsburgh, as you're heading towards the airport on the Parkway West, there's a
Carpenters
Union training school there. And to your point, yeah, you probably have to be a little on the younger side, but nonetheless, I mean, you can sign up for that and they'll pay for your training. You know, you don't pay to go to school there. They, you know, I think it's free, or they pay you to go and learn to be an apprentice. You know,
there's right.
a big building on the side of the road there that, you know, for carpenters. I forget. It's a Carpenters Union building, you know?
It is. It's a nicely built building, too.
I hope so, but, you know, but, yeah. And, okay, back to what we talk about all the time about the Make America Great Again. Yeah, we're going to need people like that. How else are we going to be great again if we don't have good people to build the buildings that we need to occupy and or live in and or work in, right? And or machinists to build the tools that we need and the appliances and all of that sort of stuff and the infrastructure and welders.
Mm-hmm.
You know, without those people and new people coming in all the time just to, you know, keep the number of people with those skills available, it's going to be tough. I mean, look at what the nursing industry is going through right now with, you know, the shortage there because they're burning out and, you know, they're having all sorts of difficulties keeping employment, you know, nurses interested in showing up for work and stuff like that. I mean, you know, they're giving like double and triple overtime, I've heard stories about. I've heard that recently, I forget which health system it was, but they basically said, even if you have COVID symptoms, wear your mask and come in. And okay, they might put you on the COVID floor, but nonetheless, wear your mask and come in. I mean, they're that hurting for people to come in, you know, for the nurses, for the nursing staff.
Right. So real quick to finish up, Punk Rabbit was talking about, that's all fear based, Ed. And he was talking, I'm not sure exactly what he was talking about, but, maybe it was the fact that, it's kind of hard to make it into unions when you're a certain age, or the fact that you know you have to be you know, be told what to do for so many years. But maybe that's what he was talking about. But I'm not sure. But I am 100% into, if we're going to make America great again, and we're going to be sufficient and have all kinds of great industry again and production, we're going to have to we're going to need all the trades people we can get in short order.
Exactly.
And
or people getting that knowledge to operate those machines once the buildings and factories are built.
Oh yeah, I mean, just being in like I know my my uncle, my great uncle, he was a you know, he worked the crane in a steel factory, right?
Yeah.
And, and that wasn't in. He had to take classes and learn it, and he was just you know, it wasn't that easy of a job, but he was something he excelled at. He could move all the ingots and the you know, the steel work around, and you know, because it was all timely based, and you know, you have all this molten steel coming out, and you had to be able to work with it and use it, and so you know, you always had to be on and working the crane, and that was one thing that he was always he was good at, right?
Mm-hmm.
So at any rate, I think and that's interesting. We'll come back to the hospital after the break. I was going to say that that I was when I was out of work for a period of time, and I borrowed a bobcat from somebody, and I was good at using it. And then my friend's dad said, "Hey, can you come down here with the bobcat and, you know, just move some dirt around for me?" And I did that. He's like, "You do that so well." And the neighbor was watching, and he said, "That's because you it's because you play all those video games, isn't it?" And I'm like, you know, I don't know if that's true or not, but it might be that I got, you know, good at driving a bobcat because I played video games and, you know, used joysticks and stuff like that.
Right. Yeah, and have independent motion for your different hands, as opposed to, okay, left hand is for decoration only and everything's done with the right hand or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
But, yeah, you know, that this conversation got started because of that kid's story. And it's like, I don't know, that's a little too sensitive for me. I mean,
exactly. Kid,
just be thankful that somebody's thinking of adopting you, and the fact that they feed you, clothe you, and give you a place to stay. You know, let's start with the basics of survival there. These people did that, and you're going to turn your back on them. You're going to criticize them because they didn't want to make rice for you for breakfast?
Exactly.
Come on.
All right.
You know, did they make? I mean, it's one thing if they didn't make breakfast for you, period. But, you know, that's like, "Well, gee, Dad, I'm sorry. I wanted steak, not hamburger or lobster."
Right, right.
For dinner. You made dinner, but that's not the point. I didn't want that for dinner.
I think we're on break now.
Okay.
I apologize. I can't hear it. It's time. So,
listen,
we will
radio,
be back. 5 minutes. Thank you.
We'll be right back after this message.
Join me and the Brian Rouge Show on Revolution Radio, Eastern Standard Time, every Tuesday night from 6 to 8. We talk about the four most vital things, in my view, affecting all of humanity. Number one is UFOs and aliens and their agenda for the advancement of humanity. Number two is the Jewish establishment's control over all aspects of human civilization. Number three, the truth about Adolf Hitler, how he was the opposite of what we've been told. Number four is Advanced Ancient Global Civilizations. Join me on the Brian Rouge Show, Tuesday nights from 6 to 8 on Studio B on Revolution Radio.
The pill has been taken. The blinders are off. Are we in the end game? Or are we simply living a replay of a time that's already happened? With no choices. Different people have different points of view. When it comes to creation versus evolution, my point of view, we were created to evolve. The Red Pill. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m. Eastern in Studio B. www.freedomslips.com and revolution.radio. check it out.
Everyone, it's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
I am Bill Johnson. Some consider my efforts to be an underground law school. I am not an attorney, and I do not give legal advice. I teach. That's lawful and legal. Consider yourself served. You are to appear Wednesday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern, Studio A. My forte? Foreclosure and contract law. Grab your legal pad and pen. Learn a broad spectrum of law, spanning administrative, criminal, family, tort, and federal law. Fools and losers cling to old cases. I dissect and comment on the latest rulings that control the courts. Don't be a loser. And if you don't appear, you will be held in contempt.
The original machine had a base plate of prefamulated amulite surmounted by a malleable logarithmic casing in such a way that the two spurving bearings were in a direct line with a panometric fan. The lineup consisted simply of six hydrocoptic Marzal vanes, so fitted to the ambifacient lunar wane shaft that side fumbling was effectively prevented. The main winding was of the normal lotus o-deltoid type placed in panendermic semi-voloid slots of the stator, every seventh conductor being connected by a non-reversible tremie pipe to the differential girdle spring on the up end of the gram meters.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio, taking the confusion out of transmutated lunar girdle springs for 4 years and running. Revolution Radio, the number one listener-supported alternative media radio on the planet. I want to thank everybody for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the one place where information never sleeps. Revolution, Revolution Radio!
All right, let's show them what we got now.
Okay, I start talking here. I'm not talking to music, because I can't hear it. So,
all right. Thanks for listening while we take that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah,
thank
we're going to get back to your host.
We had a good first hour. We were talking about lots of different things. Rice and trade schools and college and leftists, communists. So... And is our country being taken over by communists, asks Mr. Fleeberg. Let's see, is Mr. Jeff back yet? He is not. So,
I am.
Oh, he is back.
Just blowing my nose, that's all.
Hey.
And so is our country being taken over by the communists?
Yes.
Well, we can certainly argue at a minimum the socialists, or at least they're trying to turn us into socialists. That being said, from our last week's discussion and looking at GDP, we've got a very close-knit relationship with China, just with our trading of goods and services. So that's and that was a fear I remember in the 80s with the Japanese. It's like, okay, you know, Japan's going to own everything, you know, because of all of our trade dealings with them. So, you know.
Right. But what did we find out about the Japanese is that, you know, they had kind of cooked the books. Their government kind of cooked the books in their numbers and everything, right? They had they said they were much further along in production and everything. They kind of did their economy dog and pony show. And then it turned out that their government didn't produce as much as it said it had. And they kind of, you know, they recoiled for a long time, right?
And yes, they did.
Really, I mean, never really to return. I mean, they were on, they're, right, we said last week they're on par with Germany But the idea was is that, you know, they were going to
overtake us
at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that same can be said for China, right? Can the same be said? I mean, is this you know, we talk about that too. Is you know, China is a communist country. However, is their economy side, is that really a communist country, right? Because they are socialistic, but really, yeah. they really are trying to what? Give America the best bang for its buck. There is some competition. You know, they don't really, there's not a arm of China that says, America, you want this, so this is what you get. No. America says, this is what we want, and we're going to find it somewhere. And somewhere, you know, some company in China says, we can do that for you, right?
Mm-hmm.
So while it's a communist country, at the same time, there's a lot of capitalism going on, right? Because
absolutely.
Because if China wasn't able to make the iPhone for us, we would go somewhere where it was able to be made, right?
Wholeheartedly agree.
So,
wholeheartedly agree. We tend to be impatient with those sorts of things.
All right. Because we want to get stuff to market, and we want to sell it, and we want to make a profit off of it, and we want to do it better the next time. You know?
Agreed.
So,
yep.
So to that, you know, there was one thing that Mike Rowe. You familiar with Mike Rowe, Dirty Jobs guy?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. He was talking recently, and he was talking about what to do, you know, when you're looking for a vocation, right? What should you choose to do? You know, go to college, do a trade, what? You know, people say, hey, follow your dreams. What are you passionate about? What drives you, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you find out what your passion is, do that, right? There's that phrase, that almost proverbial phrase that says that, you know, he who likes his work, you know, never works a day again in his life. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
If you like your job, you never have to work another day in your life, right? Because you're doing something that brings you pleasure, right?
Right.
Well, Mike Rowe says, yeah, not so much. Because just because you have a passion for something doesn't mean that you're good at it. Right?
Good point. Right.
So maybe following your passion is not such a good idea. Because what if you stink at your passion? You can't get paid
for it.
You're gonna starve, right?
That's a good point. Yeah.
It's best sometimes to keep your passion as a hobby, right? Something you dabble in when you have time. But not what puts food on the table.
Right. And you can dabble very seriously at it, but, you know, it doesn't need to be the thing that puts food on the table.
I was thinking about that because, like, I was thinking about a career change, a life career change that maybe the career I had, information security, was not really something that I wanted to do for the rest of my life. You know, when it came down to it, I got kicked around and beaten up over, you know, over this field, and whether or not I was being treated fairly or not or whatever, it just seemed like something that just kind of lost its interest to me, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I was going to do something else. Well, so I wanted to try my hand at different things. Like I said, I wanted to go to electrical school. I found that I was locked out of that. And whether or not you believe that, you know, I could have gotten an electrical tradesman and, you know, made some money without being part of a union or not. I don't, not in Pittsburgh, not in the Pennsylvania area anyway.
Well, not major construction. I mean, I'm sure you could go around and be like a neighborhood handyman, but right. Like if you wanted to work on a construction site, a major construction site, you definitely have to have your union card.
Exactly.
In this state, anyway, right? Yeah.
So, and I wanted to do acting. You know, I wanted to try my hand at acting. I thought that was always something I wanted to do. Some passions of mine, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when it came down to it, I had to get a job. And I got a job in information security. And that put food on the table, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, whether I'm thrilled about the job every day or what have you, I'm good at it. And because I'm good at it, I get some satisfaction out of that, right?
Yeah.
And I yearn to be better at it, right? Is it something I love?
Same here.
No. Is it something I like? Probably not. But it's something that puts food on the table, and I like it.
And it puts food on the table consistently.
Exactly. And so that's what I do. And I'm happy. I'm happy that I can put food on the table consistently. I'm happy that I can learn more and do my craft better. Whether I like it or not, I still like it better than starving.
Yes, and homeless and starving.
So it is it is satisfaction to me, even though it's not my passion. So.
Yeah, I can agree with that, definitely. I'm in very much the same mindset as you. It's like most days I like what I do. I don't necessarily love it, but I like it. And like you said, it makes me good, steady money, and I'm good enough at it that you know, I can keep doing it and people still want me to do it instead of like, you're still here? Why are you still here? You know?
Why does
your badge still work?
And to that point, you know, there's many, it doesn't have to be information security. There's many jobs that I'm sure you would be well suited for. You know, there's a lot of jobs that have the same type of qualities. You know, I mean, I'm sure they're probably all IT jobs, but I'm saying that IT in general, you know, there's a certain acumen you need, right, to be able to succeed within it.
Absolutely.
Some are better at programming, some know Linux better, right? Some are better with databases. Some are better with networks. But at the same time, it's just, you know, information technology with, you know, in different compartments, right?
Right.
So I have to say I'm really lucky to be a part alive in this part of history because I don't know what else I'd do. I don't know what I'd do to make money.
See, I've always got a plan B. And as my dad pointed out, you know, I can always go and work at a restaurant, pretty much any restaurant. It doesn't have to be a Chinese restaurant, right? I can be a sous chef in any restaurant. I can work majority of the equipment in a restaurant, not an issue, you know? And so I can go anywhere. There are restaurants and people want to be fed. And it's like, I can get a job doing that, you know? And no, it's not the kind of money that I'm used to doing information security, but, you know, some money's better than no money. I mean, you know, if it came down to it, you know, it's like, okay, I can do that. Been there, done it anyways, right?
Yeah, well, sure. I mean, there'd be something synonymous for me as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the same time, I don't know. I mean, I'd like to think I'd be good at a restaurant because I worked food service, you know, in college and before college and, you know, so I guess I have about 5 years in food service.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and you definitely have the personality for food service because or chef, because you have this, you have a very good attitude about you. You have a very pleasant attitude. You have a very outgoing personality. These are all things that people in the food industry, you know, need to, they need to cater to their consumers, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And that's a very, you know, that's a very good skill you have, which, you know, is not actually a very good skill most IT people have, if you noticed. There's not a lot of IT people that are really outgoing people, that are really just chipper happy people all the time, you know, on the outside, maybe inside, but, you know, there's not a lot of extroverts. Unnecessary.
Very true. Very true. But this conversation is very similar to the conversations I have with some of the interns we get. I tell them it's just as important for them to learn and understand and recognize what they don't like as it is what they do like. Because let's face it, they're late teenagers, early 20-somethings. They haven't lived enough life yet, had enough life experiences yet to really get an idea of what they like and what they don't like, you know? And, you know, again, it's just as important to say, you know what? That kind of work sucks. Okay. Well, that's a data point. You know, you don't want to do that again. That's good. That's something you learn from it. Then move on and, you know, with that experience and see if you can do something else and or do something different, right? And do it better. Because you learn from that bad experience that, okay, yeah, okay, here's some things that I didn't like about the job and or, you know, tasks or certain items about the job, you know. It just is important to learn those sorts of things. And to your point about the soft skills, I tell them if you think you going into IT means you never have to deal with people, you're sadly mistaken because, you know, we typically work as a team anymore, even when you're working on code. You work as a team to work on code. You don't just sit there in silence by yourself in a room and develop software. It doesn't work that way anymore. Now, that stereotype is unrealistic in today's world.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And that's right. Exactly. I got to work with someone from another team today and, you know, looking at a script and working with Linux pieces, and, you know, it wasn't that I, you know, not that I had a better understanding of what was going on in this Linux script, but I had the idea, I had the path, the focus, the vision of where the script should go, you know, and and worked through it, and we got to the right place. So that was really you know, it wouldn't have gotten done had I not been able to reach out to the other person, work through the problems, and help get it done, correct?
Right. And communicate effectively so that the other person understood what you meant and you understood what they meant to get it accomplished. And that's the thing. Those are communication skills. Again, it's not like you work in a vacuum. No one works in a vacuum anymore, you know, unless you're one of those artists who sells things either on their own website or on Etsy or something like that, right? But if you work in any kind of environment that's greater than one person, it's like, you're going to need those interpersonal skills. No way around that. Yeah. Or even just working with a customer, you need interpersonal skills.
Oh, for sure, for sure. And it's interesting because when I started my first job, I was I worked on a proprietary help desk that helped out contractors and electrical distributors. So they sold circuit breakers and switches and everything, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, gotcha.
I taught them how to order their product for our company using our online order entry system. And I got there and I'm like, wait, I have to learn this proprietary system. No other company uses it. So this is the only place this is good for it, right? What am I doing? Mm-hmm. Why am I learning this? This is I can't retire on this, right?
No.
So I wanted to. Nope. So I looked at. I wanted to be in hardware because I started my own company in college. You know, making computers and fixing computers, and I'm like, yeah, I could be a desktop guy and get all the stuff to work, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I thought I wanted to do. But then I looked at that too, and I'm like, wait, do I want to be the guy that fixes printers and printer problems and all those crazy Windows issues all the time? Definitely not. I don't want to be that person even less. So I'd better just embrace this for now and see where this takes me, right?
Right.
So where it took me was that people weren't able to get connected to the order entry system because they were having modem problems. And being a hardware guy, I was easily able to troubleshoot modem issues. So I got all the modem issues. And before I know it, I was sent on the road to places throughout the U.S. to fix their modem problems.
Mm-hmm.
And one, I did most of them by phone. And ones that were the big customers that they, you know, weren't listening to me, they sent me out there they sent me on the road to do these.
Right, yeah.
And then they sent me out to do training on this system. But it was the modem was when I started talking to the network guys downstairs. And I'm like, okay, how does it connect? How do all these modems connect downstairs? And they talked about the Shiva bank.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, they talked about how, like, you know, how they used WANs and wide area networks and MUXes for other different places and everything. And that's just like, really? That was just so interesting to me. And it was because of that, that's how I got into networking. That's how I wanted to do networking. So that is, but I wouldn't have gotten that start had I not taken a leap and start to learn something that, you know, I thought was useless.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It turned out to be pretty good, and I was a networking guy.
Right. It's worth the effort to learn. Yeah.
And then networking, I got into, you know, firewalls and firewalls into network security and then overall security. So, and here we are.
Right. And here we are. Yeah. And I tell the interns that as well. It's like, give it a shot. You know, if you can get your foot in the door, there may be opportunities to move around the company and you can try different things and you might find something that you want to do and or that you're good at and you want to do. That's for sure. You know,
right, for sure.
Worth the effort, you know, getting in someplace and having steady income and is take some of the stress off and then you can continue looking for work. Nobody says you have to stay there for 25, 30 years, right? Just be there and continue looking for work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Definitely. Yeah.
So, anyway, what else are we talking about? I've been bringing up all the topics. What did you want to talk about?
How about from last week? We were talking about the football game where if they ended it as a tie, they both get in, and I guess, you know, they were trying to be professional competitive athletes, and one team won and one didn't, you know.
Did you happen to catch that game?
I did not watch it. No, no.
It was the Raiders versus the Chargers.
Chargers, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And before the game, because I listened to pregame for the Steelers and I listened to postgame for the Steelers. Mm-hmm. And in the great radio, yawning. For the pregame, someone had asked Mike.
Okay, well, let's break into the NPR voice then to get our audience primed for sleep.
Right.
And in the pregame, yes, Ed?
Yes, they asked, Mike Tomlin, Coach Mike Tomlin was asked what he thought about the tie and if that could happen. And Tomlin said that was the most asinine question he'd heard in a long time, that that's not how football works, that these were division rivals. Division rivals only want to pound each other into the dirt. That's what good rivals do. They will never entertain such a ludicrous idea that they both tie and they both get into the playoffs. Kind of nonsense. They don't want the other side to get into the playoffs. Thank you very much. And I watched the game, and the Raiders were well ahead. And I'm like, okay, this is not going to end a tie. You know, this, you can let your guard down here, right? Then the Chargers started coming back, and they tied. They tied at the end of the game, end of regulation. It was tied.
Oh, overtime. Here we go. Yeah.
And then there's 10 minutes of overtime. And the the Chargers had the ball first, and they got the ball first, and they went and they didn't score, and they kicked off. So that meant the next score wins.
Okay.
Well, the Raiders, they dominated a bunch of the 10 minutes with their with their drive that led nowhere. So the Raiders took over, and time just keeps on ticking and ticking and ticking. And they finally, luckily, get in the field goal range. And they just tick the time off, and they tick it down to 2 seconds. And then they kick the field goal and win. So the Raiders end up winning 25-22. But it was tied at the end of regulation. Something wow. that 22-22. That's not 22 is not really a score that's easy to gain, right?
I would have to agree. I mean, three touchdowns, excuse me, is 21. So did they go for 2 points at one point, or
they went for 2 points? How do you missed, and then they end up getting a field goal, right? I think that's I think that's how it went. Yeah. So
yeah, that would do it.
Right. So it was just, and one team got two field goals. So that's how that happened. But yeah, it was just it was a nail biter, because, you know, first the Steelers had a win, then the Jaguars, the Jacksonville Jaguars had to beat the Colts. And then you're like, oh, this is the easiest thing. This game is not going to end in a tie. And it did end in a tie, except for overtime.
Right. And I did read some article where Chris Collinsworth was like talking about the tie and how, or, you know, the Steelers would be eliminated if they tied and this, that, and the other thing, and like brought it up like 400 times or something or other. And
he did.
It just reminds me of the fact that, well, he is a former Cincinnati Bengal, and anytime I listen to him and he's doing a Steelers game, he always tends to savor the moments when the Steelers do something bad. You know, he's always got some sort of comment to, you know, some sort of dig he has to feel a need to throw out there, you know? And it just, I don't know. I don't get that from Tony Romo, you know, when he's talking about one of his, you know, former rivals and some of the other former football players. They don't seem to do that, but, you know, or maybe I'm just more sensitive because it's Chris Collinsworth. But, you know, he just comes off as sometimes ridiculous, you know? Sometimes an ass, even, for that sort of stuff.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Well, you know, he is one that I could never listen to. I never liked his commentary. And it's not necessarily because he's anti-Steelers, which he is, but it's just, I don't like his commentary. But when he was annoying, he was trying to, you know, rub it in. He's like, oh, the Steelers fans have their heart in their mouth now. The Steelers fans, they're clutching their towels now. The Steelers fans, And even at one point, Al Michaels is like, he's like, man, you're really on the Steelers fans, aren't you? You know.
Right. This is not the Steelers game. Sorry, bud. You know, it's the Las Vegas Raiders versus the Los Angeles Chargers here, buddy. Well, are you watching a different game here? You know? You know, and how would those two fan bases feel? It's like, could you stick to the game here? You know, right now we're caring about the game that's happening on the field, not the stupid Steelers, you know? Could care less.
The only one that I liked listening to less than Chris Collinsworth is Phil Simms. You remember Phil Simms? He was just always a snoozer. Like, I felt like I could just fall asleep watching him narrate the game.
He's very Ben Stein, just kind of monotone, just kind of slow.
And the Lions kick it off. Yeah. Here they go. Here comes the run up. He gets to the 22-yard line, and he is tackled by the defense. So, you know, it's like, wow.
How to suck the life out of a game. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, and Tony Romo, there's people that don't like Tony Romo, but actually I do. I thought I was not going to like his play calling. I thought he was going to be annoying. And actually, I like him.
Mm-hmm.
He's not so bad.
I don't follow the NFC that much. So, yeah, he typically does NFC games, right? Well, no, he does the broadcasting for CBS. So I guess sometimes he does the Steelers game. And I just turn on DVE because I like listening to them better. And I've only heard him a couple times. I don't mind him. But you're right, Phil Simms. Chris Collinsworth. You know? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I definitely listen to the home team. And people, you know, they're like, oh, you listen to WDVE because they're not going to say anything bad about the Steelers. No, that's not true.
They say plenty of bad things. They just don't dwell on it.
Right, exactly. And
you know, if somebody makes a bad play, they're going to call it as a bad play, and they're going to talk about it a little bit, but then they're going to move on to the postgame show.
Yeah, I really loved listening to Ted Shumpin because he really knew his game and he really knew how to describe what was going on, and he called the plays. He's like, oh, they're doing the Wildcat again. You know, he had to explain it what it was. And there's just, I mean, I learned so much from him. And I loved his color commentary. And Bill Hillgrove doing the, the play-by-play.
Play-by-play. Yep.
Man, I really agree. All of it.
I agree. They were very entertaining, very listenable. Absolutely. Very, very listenable to me. And, this year they're doing the Craig Wolfley with Max Starks and stuff. And they're good. I've always loved Wolfley with his crazy little phrases like lost description and imagination and, slobber knocker and stuff like that.
That to me is ads,
you know, they're kind of the non Phil Simms, right? It's like, okay, this is color commentary. You know, you're adding color and, you know, character to it. Otherwise, yes, you could just sit here and describe it like a golf announcer, right? Okay. Standing there, 14th tee.
Yeah, right.
Lining up his truck.
Cinderella.
Okay. And pray tell, why do you whisper? You're nowhere near where this golfer is. Right?
Oh, right.
Wherever the camera is, but that's nowhere near the 14th hole or the 14th tee. It's probably not even near the first tee. So it's like, why are we whispering? You know?
Right, right. And they, exactly. And, man. I like Craig Wolfley and I like Max Starks. I used to work. Mm-hmm. Used to work downtown, and when he was a Steeler, and he started out, he lived right around the corner from where I worked.
Wow!
Mm-hmm. And he drove a big black Avalanche, Chevy Avalanche, and he parked it right where I worked. And I'd see him walk into his car, big dreads and everything, like big dreadlocks and everything. And big guy. And he was such a nice guy. You know, I talked to him. My brother would talk to him. And he was just chill, nice, nice guy. And so I'm glad that he got on the sidelines. Because I think he does. I like his commentary. I like what he contributes to the game. And he doesn't have dreads. He didn't have.
No, he just had long hair. It wasn't dreads. It was just long hair.
Yeah, it was just long hair. I don't think you're right.
Yeah.
So, and he started the same year as Big Ben did. They were both.
No, him and Tunch started it. They're from the 80s. You mean broadcasting? That could be true, but no. Wolfley.
No, I'm saying Max Starks.
Dunbar.
Craig Wolfley and Tunch Ilkin played together.
Correct.
Max Starks played with rookie season was the same year as Ben Roethlisberger.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Oh, if that's what you meant, then yes, I totally agree.
Yeah. That's what I mean. Yeah. Right.
Okay. Sorry. Yep. Yep.
No. Yeah. You're right. Oh yeah. Craig and Tunch were best friends. They. They were really good friends together. Really.
Yeah. I think they roomed together in. You know.
Training camps and everything.
Camp.
Yeah. They did. I remember that. WDVE and some Steelers came. I don't know. It might have been Craig Wolfley came to my high school, and they were talking, and they were saying that they were talking stories about a training camp.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, man, this rookie here is so drunk he can't even talk straight. And the other guy's like, you idiot, he's talking to his mom on the phone. He's Turkish.
He's Turkish, right? That's funny.
He's not drunk.
He's not drunk. He's Turkish.
That's right.
That's funny.
So.
But, yeah, that's good stuff. But, yeah, that was interesting to hear. Yeah, I mean. Potentially, yeah, you could let the gamesmanship go into those concepts and like, yeah, what would you do? Would you just go for the ties? I don't think so. They're professionals. They wouldn't do that.
Now,
you know,
unfortunately, I mean, that's American football.
Yeah.
Soccer is another thing. Soccer teams do that. They, when those situations come about, soccer teams have been known to bag it so they both can advance.
Really? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Let me see. There was one I was looking for. Teams.
Well, football's a tougher sport. I'm sorry. It's a lot more physical sport. You know, any contact in soccer is more coincidental than on purpose, whereas every play in football, you know, you line up across from your opponent there, and you smash each other. Whereas soccer, you know, there may be some intentional contact, but for the most part, it's unintentional. You're bumping or elbowing or what have you, but you're not, like, trying to tackle, American football tackle. You're doing a slide tackle, you know?
Oh, yeah, right. I have this respect for soccer, but I don't know. It only goes so far.
Their cardio is amazing. Like basketball players, their cardio amazes me that you can run and move for as long as you can. But beyond that, you know, the drama that goes on when one of the players gets knocked over and they're writhing on the ground for 5 minutes and then they get up like nothing happened. It's like, really? Okay. I don't know. Ambulance should have carted you off with all of that going on.
Oh yeah. Oh, I know. It's kind of cartoonish in a way.
It is.
It's you know, Wile E. Coyote gets smacked in the face with a...
the Acme frying pan.
The Acme frying pan that's three times bigger than anyone ever uses. And his face gets flat and his neck contorts into an accordion.
Right? Yes, yes.
And in the next scene, you know, he's chasing out to the Roadrunner again. That's what I feel like, you know, that you know, they should have some, you know, the Acme ball hits him on the forehead and the Acme insignia, you know, stamp gets on their forehead for as hard as they seem that it hits them, you know.
Right. Absolutely. You know, yeah, and all the clutching of knees and writhing around, it's like, oh, okay, then, you know, yeah, should I get you the Acme air cast and some Acme crutches to hobble around? Uh-oh! Look, he's up and he's running like a maniac. How'd that happen?
Now the only thing that I think is worse than that is women's basketball. They do that on the court as well, and it's just like... Everything is a flag and a, you know, and a card as well. And, you know, it's, in the NBA, obviously there's players that foul out, right? And there's players get kicked out, but it doesn't seem to be a large percentage of the time, right?
Right. Because if you foul out, you're not there for your team. You can't play any more minutes. You can't score more points. You might as well just go to the locker room. You cannot help your team.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I think it happens a great deal more in women's basketball.
I don't watch women's basketball, so I don't know enough to comment. I know at least in college, I love watching women's college because it's, you know, the finesse and technique, not just, you know, grabbing at the ball and the punching and the kicking and the, you know, that I find reprehensible in the men's basketball game. You know, it's like, what are you doing? You're just kind of like grabbing at the ball or, you know, you're flailing elbows and you're pushing and shoving. And it's like, well, that's not how the game's supposed to be, you know?
Oh, no. No, women's college basketball is can be exciting for sure. Women's professional basketball is a drain. Can you name one professional WNBA team?
Nope. I cannot. Again, it's just not a sport I follow, so I couldn't name one WNBA star, let alone a team. You know, I don't follow professional basketball, but it's like, okay, LeBron James, Kevin Durant are some names that come to mind, you know, don't know what teams they play for. I know LeBron used to be for, Cleveland Cavaliers and they bounced around a lot, but you know, beyond that, I don't know much about them.
Yeah. The Los Angeles Sparks, the Chicago Sky, the Las Vegas Aces, the Phoenix Mercury. Never heard of these teams.
None of them. Never heard of any of them.
The Dallas Wings. Now, was it one female athlete? Was it the soccer player? The soccer player is married to the basketball player, the Olympic basketball star. Okay. I can't remember. Anyway, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
I apologize.
No. Yeah, like if anything, to me, basketball, men's basketball, they need to raise the baskets at least another foot or two. No, I mean it.
No,
I
think the idea right.
when the game came about was 10 feet was unimaginable for a human being to be able to jump that high. So you had to have some skill and it would be difficult to score 2 points. Whereas now, even the smallest person on any team can do a slam dunk. And it's like, okay, well, to me that takes away from it because, okay, you can jump that high and point blank range, boom, the ball goes in. as opposed to you having to take a shot or a bank shot or a jump shot or something like that. You know, that takes true skill as opposed to, oh, okay, I'm naturally gifted that I can jump that high. Right.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
I mean, I just much rather watch shooting the basket and or, you know, even if it's a layup or something like that, it's like, okay, yeah, that took skill to bank the ball, and otherwise it's not a layup. Whereas a slam dunk, it's like, okay, you just kind of jump up, and I've seen some of the players, like, they're above the rim. So it's like, okay, well, how much of a challenge is it then, really and truly?
Right, right. So did you know that the basketball is almost, you know, when it started, it didn't have a lot of following, and it almost died, and it was almost gone. Did you know the story about how basketball was saved from extinction?
No.
Well, it was from a coach. He noticed that, like, you know, people were doing a lot of dribbling, a lot of passing, not a lot of shooting. And because of that, there wasn't a lot of scoring. And it was just a lot, it was just, you know, it was boring.
Sure.
So then this gym teacher actually said, hey, you know, we gotta force people to shoot. So he invented the shot clock.
Oh, okay.
And he wanted
sure.
to, he had counted, and he said that what a shot was like, what's the shot clock for? You have to make a shot every...
guessing, what, 20?
25 seconds? 24 seconds or something. Anyway, he had said that, you know, it was 40 every 48 seconds on average. And he's like, okay, we got to get that down, cut in half. So he devised the shot clock to force people to shoot every 24 seconds. So they would shoot twice as much.
Mm-hmm.
And that sped up the game, and that sped up that came with you know, a lot more better strategy, right? If you're gonna have to shoot every 24 seconds, then you're gonna have to have quick strategy. You're gonna have to work together as a team more, right?
So, right.
You know, it was just the idea. That, you know, that's how you're going to get more shots.
And I don't know when that change occurred, but I do remember hearing way back when about when a team was ahead, what they would do would take what was called the four corners strategy, which was, okay, we just stand at like the four corners of the court and like pass the ball back and forth. And then, yeah. To your point, without a shot clock, you could just play keep away as long as you liked, right? As long as the other team didn't get the ball, you could just keep passing the ball back and forth, and that was permitted. So that would make sense to have a shot clock and force you to shoot.
Exactly.
Now, otherwise, it could get very boring, you know, because then you're just passing it back and forth, back and forth, back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's exactly right. Let's see. It was not the product of a painstaking regression analysis. No lofty arithmetic was required in the process. In fact, they probably didn't even use a calculator. From analyzing Spock scores from previous seasons, they merely deduced that the most entertaining games usually feature each team hoisting about 60 shots or 120 per game. You know, 120 points per game. That number was divided by 48 minutes or 2,880 seconds, the total time of an NBA game, and the end product was 24 seconds. So that's how they came up with that.
Okay.
So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you must do something every 24 seconds. Well, try to score every 24 seconds. Yeah. Makes sense.
And that makes, you know, that definitely makes basketball more exciting.
Definitely. Unlike baseball, which, okay, there's no clock. It can go on as long as it wants to go on, right? You know?
Oh, sure.
If a game goes to 30, I mean, you know, I don't know what the longest game was. I'm sure it was at least in the 20s innings-wise, but still, it's kind of like, okay, this could just drag on and on, you know? It's like, wow, okay. You know?
Oh, yeah, right. I mean, baseball is a different, you know, different strategy, right? Different game altogether. And, you know, I like watching baseball. I didn't like watching it as a kid. I thought it was the most, you know, a pretty boring sport. Wasn't keen on going to the games either. It just seemed like it seemed pretty boring. But it's grown on me over the years. You know?
I've actually gone backwards. I used to like it more as a kid, and I like it less now. And it has everything to do with that player strike all those years ago, because it was like, okay, you guys are making millions and millions of dollars, and you're arguing over that. It's like, really, guys? You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was in the 80s, right? Was that 88 or something?
Something like that. I forget when it was, but it's like, okay, I officially don't need you anymore. Thank you.
Yeah, for sure. Let's see, Major League Baseball.
No, I used to love listening to it, and like, especially when they were on the West Coast, I'd get done with work, I'd get cleaned up, and I'd put it on my little transistor radio right by my bed, and I'd fall asleep listening to Pirates Radio. It was quite nice.
It looks like there was one in 1981 and one in 1994.
I think it was a 94 strike that really made it distasteful, you know, because it's like you guys are making tens of millions of dollars and you're arguing over money, you know. Mm-hmm. Gee, don't you make enough? You certainly make more than the average individual in this country.
Yes, Field of Dreams was popular, so somebody had a sign that said Field of Greed.
Mm-hmm.
When a strike, owners win, players win, fans lose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what it felt like, you know. It's like, okay, you're just out for the pocketbook, and, well, let's face it, you know, Pittsburgh Pirates are a perfect example of that, where the owner is unwilling to spend money to make the team any better, and yet the diehard fans still go. And, you know, as a result, they've had all these losing seasons, and the owner has no incentive to spend money because he's not interested in winning. He's interested in making money off of all the side attractions, you know, the concessions and the merchandise, and Lord only knows what else. But, you know, Andor is using it as a tax write-off to counterbalance all of his other earnings. I guess, I don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, he bought a sports team for the wrong reasons. You know, I would, okay, maybe I'm being delusional here, but if I had that kind of money to buy a sports team, I'd want to buy it and win and be competitive, not just buy one to have one and be perennial losers and laughingstocks of the whole league.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, why own something to, you know, be mediocre at best, right?
At best, right.
Yeah, I mean, but at the same time, I mean, the Kansas City Royals, I mean, they were owned in part by David Glass, which was a big wig at the Walmart, and has a building named after him, the David Glass Technical Building. And he, you know, owned the Royals and didn't want to spend a lot of money. And lo and behold, the Royals won the,
World Series.
The World Series. Not too long
ago. They sure did. Yeah, not that long. What, 5 years ago, maybe? 10?
Less than 10, I'm
sure. Less than 10, I want to say.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So what is it? It's not about the spending, then. Is it just about poor development from the farm team and or making poor you know, decisions about trading players or trading for players, getting rid of players?
I mean, it's all the above with the Pirates, right?
I think so. Yeah.
The problems are many. It's the money. Yes. It's not development. It's not developing the farm teams. Not playing your minor teams properly. It's everything.
Yeah. All of it. It's the whole enchilada.
Which is a shame because, you know, they could be a great franchise again. If they just,
they have the loyal fan base.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, Pittsburgh Pirate fans have been going for decades since they won the last World Series in 79, right? So it's not like nobody's going to these games. People want to root for them.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Jeez. They want them to succeed. It's just that the ownership doesn't care. You know, they don't necessarily want them to fail, but they don't care enough to want them to succeed either.
Yeah.
As strange as that sounds.
And then, you know, we might lose the Penguins at some point.
Yeah. It could happen.
Could happen in 7 years. That'd be bad.
Yeah. Well, where do you think they'd move them to now that the Fenway Group owns them, where they own the major interest?
Yeah, could be Boston.
Really? The Bruins going to leave then?
No, I don't know. Just have another team there. I don't know.
I don't know if that is a large enough market to have two teams. It's not like New York where you can have the Rangers and – who's the other team? New York Rangers and Islanders.
Yeah.
You know? Or the Mets and the Yankees, or, you know, the Jets and the Giants.
Or the – wait, there's another – there's the Jets, the Giants, well, the – and well, obviously, everybody forgets about the Bills. The Bills. The Buffalo Bills. But
yeah. I'm sorry.
The Buffalo
Bills. Well, but that's the other side of the state, though.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
But or even basketball, they have the New York Knicks and the New Jersey Nets, right? I mean, they're all within that metro region, I believe. So, you know, they could have two of everything there. But they've got darn near 10 million people, so, yeah, you're going to have enough fan base for all of those teams and probably some overlap. But Pittsburgh's only million metro.
Oh, yeah. True. All right, believe we got to sign off here.
Oh, okay.
It is time again. Thank you very much for listening to Polite Gunfights. We hope to have Aaron back next week. Appreciate, good conversation, Mr. Jeff. Always.
Thanks.
And it went very quick.
It went very quick. Great to talk.
And I think we're off the air. I think we have to go. All right. Well, thank you.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning! Warning!
We gotta stop them! They're gonna kill us all!
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they a government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone, or human beings!
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop! You've got to win the day to the people who run it, to the people who own it. That unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well, now you've got it.
You tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell!
travels to Earth through the rainbow crystal bubbles from the furthest reaches of space and time across the dimension.